which is titled An Emerging Global Consciousness. My name is Doug Dahlstedt, and let's begin. I want to begin with a poem. This is taken after Mohawk prayer. Gratitude to Mother Earth, sailing through night and day, and to her soil, rich, rare, and sweet. In our minds, so be it. Gratitude to plants, the sun facing light-changing leaf and fine root hairs. Standing still through wind and rain, their dance is in the flowering spiral grain. In our minds, so be it. Gratitude to air, bearing the soaring swift and the silent owl at dawn. Breath of our song, clean spirit breeze. In our minds, so be it. Gratitude to wild beings, our brothers, teaching secrets, freedoms, and ways, who share with us their milk, self-complete, brave, and aware. In our minds, so be it. Gratitude to water, clouds, lakes, rivers, glaciers, holding or releasing, streaming through all our bodies, salty seas. In our minds, so be it. Gratitude to the sun, blinding, pulsing light through trunks of trees, through mists, warming caves where bears and snakes sleep, he who wakes us. In our minds, so be it. Gratitude to the great sky who holds billions of stars and goes yet beyond that, beyond all powers and thoughts, and yet is within us. Grandfather space, the mind is his wife. So be it. Many, many years ago, probably before recorded language, there was perception of the earth as a whole living thing, although that perception was generally bounded. Most people's mobility and movement throughout their space was limited by natural features. Even the great nomads had an area beyond which the planet ceased to exist. And yet there was a perception that all was alive and all was intimately bound up. We made a quantum leap in our popular culture when in 1968, or was it 69, we went to the moon and we sent back pictures of what most people had as a religious image all along, which is the image of the earth as a circle. I think it was Alan Shepard, one of the astronauts there, who had what he termed a life-changing experience being up there, coming around the backside of the moon and watching the earth rise over the rim of the moon and seeing the blue-green planet of home. Set against that vast blackness of space, here is this planet that had no boundaries on it, had no divisions, had this warm, moist ambience to it, planet Earth, home. Well, I did a little bit of investigation of when we think of Gaia, which the idea that the Earth is an organism, that it's actually imbued with powers and faculties that are the same, similar in process to our own, and yet much vaster and much grander. And set that in the context of the Earth being an organism within the organism of the cosmos, the great infinity of space that extends beyond all our comprehension. I wondered what it was to be alive. In the old, many meanings, aliveness was characterized by breath. Universe was one breathing. The idea of spirit, inspiration, things that breathe. There are other meanings to be alive. The Sanskrit word means to be sticky. And our own, The Indo-European has the same kind of background. It means to be smeared about. So if you take that a step further and follow it, if you get to be sticky, which it means to adhere to things, or to remain or to stay in one place, especially to stay alive or to stay sticky, you get an impression of the planet as a moist, sticky place. Or as one writer put it, if people from eons ago could come and sit in on this session, they might offer a wet Velcro as a model for what it means to be alive, wet, sticky stuff. What I'd like to do right now is just a brief visualization to put us on par with Mr. Shepard, the astronaut. And if you could all get comfortable for a moment, we're going to go visit the planet. Take a moment and breathe deeply from somewhere down around your navel. Breathe in and then let it go. Breathe in deeply and gently and let it go. As you continue breathing in deeply and gently, relaxing with every breath that you let go, I'd like you to allow yourself to become light, to feel as though your body was very, very, very light, lighter than even perhaps a ray of sunshine. And let yourself float up, lift off the ground, and rise up where you can see yourself sitting back in your chair. You can see other people and the room. And lift up above this building, where you can see the village. Rise higher, where you can see the watershed, the river outside, the village doors that extends up into the mountains and the valleys. Begin to see the length and breadth of it and the mountain peaks, how they're all connected in a ridge. And rise higher and see the cloud patterns distributed over the Cascades. On the west and east side of the mountains, places there are clouds and places there aren't. More rivers, more peaks. And rise higher still. You see now the basins of Puget Sound and the Great Plains extending to the east of the Cascades. Continue to rise gently higher and higher. You see the oceans, the Pacific, spilling in through the Straits of Juan de Fuca, and the vastness of the continent extending to the east and the north. The land patterns, patterns of agriculture, the drainage patterns of the rivers. Rise higher. Higher until you see the rim of the world, the curvature of the earth. The earth is still large. And rise higher yet. beyond the point where you could see anything that was human, anything that was man-made, where individual mountains lose their distinction, where it becomes much like a watercolor painting, a blur of mixture of colors, greens and browns and blues, whites. Higher still, out beyond the moon, where you're looking around the moon at the earth, floating there in the vastness of space. The great patterns of clouds. Keep rising higher, way out beyond Mars, and take the great leap beyond Jupiter. Where the Earth, if you see it at all, is just a twinkle of light. Like a soft blue sapphire. Let yourself come back now. Drift slowly toward the earth. And as you pause for a moment there in space, watching the planet, see that it has a rhythm, a pulse. That it stretches this way and that. It's not completely uniform. Become aware of the smell of the planet breathing. The wet, moist planet, the dry spaces. Let yourself drift down now, back into the Earth's atmosphere. You can imagine the Earth welcoming you home. Let yourself float back down through the layers of clouds. Back here into the Pacific Northwest. Back to this place near Lake Chelan, where the music of this place is different than any other place. And gently settle back into your chair. And when you're ready, come back into the present moment here. I used to wonder about the word, about this word here. And I wasn't sure how to pronounce it. And that bothered me for a while. And then I stopped to think, well, maybe that was really an advantage. Maybe the Earth doesn't speak in the language that we can readily converse with and that we're used to. Maybe it's better to have a word that we need to mumble. It's almost a poetic word, that a collection of sounds that none of us are quite comfortable saying. Gaia, it's Earth isn't a mother, maybe in a metaphoric sense. It's not a person, certainly. It's our own meaning of what it means to be alive has changed a lot. We, in our capacity of human beings, have assigned life levels to other organisms. There's the lower life that doesn't have any sentience to it. And then there are those sentient beings that don't have language, really, or conversation. And then there are those beings, coincidentally, ourselves, who have these wonderful things of language and theology. It's been said that we are the eyes of the world. We're the consciousness of the world. If we occupy a special place on this planet, it may be in that role, in that capacity of the planet, its own set of consciousness to understand itself. Gaia. A good definition of Gaia comes from the man who invented the term. The other day I read the physiochemical one. This is a little bit further out. This is from James Lovelock in Gaia, A New Look at Life on Earth. It's Oxford University Press, 1982. He says, the entire range of living matter on Earth, from whales to viruses, from oaks to algae, could be regarded as a single living entity capable of manipulating the Earth's atmosphere to suit its overall needs and endowed with the faculties and powers far beyond that constitute its parts. In the same way that we are made up of smaller systems, we think of them as our digestive system, our respiratory system, our reproductive system, the Earth itself is made up of smaller systems with powers that are much greater than the sum of the parts. And we being individual people and the scientists who look at that sort of thing, are just beginning to appreciate what the implications of that might be. And throughout the week here, we've talked about, well, what are the implications of that for a group that's spiritually based? And the implications seem to be that we have a different responsibility than one that we formerly had. And I'm curious to note the parallels of the kind of work that I do with the kind of work that missionaries do, where missionaries are out saving souls, and they rely on a couple of strategies, or at least two that I identify readily. One is the constant talking and showing an example of life that is a better life to be lived. And another one is the vision that says, look, you got to do this to save your soul, or else the great coming is going to come and you're going to be left behind. It's the cataclysmic interpretation. And I've been stopped by people in the village who ask me if I get discouraged doing what I do, talking to people when there's so little reaction, so few people that actually see what's going on, see it to the point where they're willing to change their own lifestyle behavior, which is a very difficult thing to do. And I guess the answer is you just have to do what you have to do. Missionaries do that. I do that. All of us in our lives, I guess, do that at one point or another. We look around at things that are true or that have meaning, and we tend to follow those. Is the planet and the people on it, are they going to change because of some cataclysmic event? Or are they going to change through this slow process of education and this perspective? It's my feeling that if people actually adopted the idea or the myth that the planet was alive, they would treat it very differently. They'd have to. This idea, I do a small ritual in my own life, which I get up and I touch the earth as part of my morning ritual. I just touch it, which is part of a recognition of that I'm going to be walking on the planet and I acknowledge its existence. I got thinking about, well, what can individual people do if they're interested, if they sort of accept this idea? How is it that they can start to develop habits, rituals, that help to reinforce that idea of the planet being alive? And one way is to have rituals like that. Something that brings you back to the knowledge that you're connected to everything else. This is a very, very old idea, mind you, and it wasn't until about the 17th century that we had the mechanistic view of the universe take hold and give rise to the Industrial Revolution, which has given us so many amazing things and made our lives very, very different, in many respects, much easier. But the idea that the world is put out there is there for us to use, and it functions basically like a machine, is an idea that I hope the influence is dwindling. And being resurrected are the old religions, the old ideas that the Earth as a planet is alive. It's really a simple message. I was talking with a fellow the other day, and for all these words, the message really is this. The fact remains that the people who profess to know a lot about these things and who love them haven't the vaguest notion of how to see nature. They don't know where to find it, they don't know how to experience it, and if they demonstrate the existence of it, they do so on a field trip, which is more of a social outing than a field trip. If anything, they do more damage to nature by their activity than they do if they never brought their kids out there at all. The point is that people should find these things out for themselves. You shouldn't have to go to some expert to know that if you look here or there, you'll find something. You're there. Just look. It's as simple as that. When I'm dealing with kids, with junior high students, and their energies are going in a million different directions, a lot of them say that they like being out in nature. And my biggest emphasis for them is keep going out there. Keep exploring this planet. Keep your heart open to hearing the music of wherever you go. When you do that a long time, you may end up where Wendell Berry ends up. And I saw this in a variety of forms throughout the 70s about traveling around the world and coming home and seeing it for the first time. Well, his interpretation from The Unforeseen Wilderness is that the world cannot be discovered by a journey of miles, no matter how long, but only by a spiritual journey, a journey of 1 inch, very arduous and humbling and joyful, by which we arrive at the ground at our feet and learn to be at home. I'd like somebody to offer me a definition of what myth is. Any thoughts on what a myth is?
It's a story that it's a story that's not true that is an analogy to something that is true.
So a myth is a story that's not true as in...
As in concretely not true, but it's true in a different sense.
So it carries a metaphorical meaning to it. Okay. When I grew up, I learned of myths as being stories that were entertaining, but didn't necessarily have any function or use at all. They were entertaining. Yeah.
It's the psychology and picture form.
It's a psychology in picture form. Well, I'm going to recommend all of you this book, or even better, if you have the money, what was done, the conversation between Billy Moyer and Joseph Campbell stands, I think, as one of the most fascinating, illuminating 6 hours that a person could spend. Joseph Campbell grew up in a religious tradition and became a mythologist. His answer to everything is you follow your bliss. That when you find stories that make sense to you, that touch some inner meaning, you follow them. And you follow them wherever they go. You find an author that calls out to you, you follow that. Read everything they've written. Understand it. For him, it was Joyce, the transitions of a young man. But this is called The Power of Myth, and it's on video cassette. You can get it you can get it through Parabola magazine. as well as some other places. He talks about one of the questions Bill Moyer asked Joseph Campbell is, do we have any myths now? And Campbell says, no, we don't. Our modern society is so divorced from the planet and from life's passages that we don't really have any myths. He gives four functions of myths, and the four functions have to do with what we traditionally think of in a religious sense. There's the great mystical connection. There are myths that lead you out into the universe where awe is the guiding feeling. It's just an incredibly awesome experience. There's the shape of the planet, cosmological shape. And science has kind of picked up that end of it. Science, in a very large way, is a modern mythology in a cosmological sense. The way things were formed, the way they're made, how they work, why they're there. There's the sociological one, and those are like the rules from the Old Testament on what to eat, what to wear, where to sleep, who to marry, where to go, when to be where. And the fourth function is the pedagogical function. That's the one that he's most interested in. That's the one that he thinks is transcendent through all societies, all times. And that is, how do all of us live a life? How do we all survive the transitions of birth into adulthood, through maturity, into death? And he says that going back to the myths is the way to do that. The myths, all of them, have a transcendent universal language. He points out that a lot of myths are contradictory if you look at them as literal truths. And that's the nature of life. He is one among many who is particularly condemning Christianity in its adherence, not just Christianity. He's condemning most religions with a little bit of softness toward Buddhism. And he sums it up by quoting one of his teachers and a Zen philosopher, Dr. Tidi Suzuki, who capsulized most religious interpretations of nature with the word God against man, man against God, God against man against nature, nature against man, nature against God, God against nature. Very funny religion.
Doug, what was your comment about Campbell regarding Buddhism? Was it soft or something like
that? Yeah, he felt that of all the world's religions, the major ones, Buddhism was the only one that really didn't make any distinction of the spirit of everything, including the spirit of man. And therefore, the spirit of the earth was easily incorporated, easily transferable into Buddhism without... There's another story. One of the delightful things about this book is that he tells a lot of stories. He tells a lot of myths. And one that caught my attention in preparing for this class was the story of the pygmy boy who found a bird in the wood that sang most beautifully. And the boy picked up the bird and brought it home. And he left it there for his father to feed. And his father looked at the bird and looked at their scant resources and said, I don't want to feed this bird. And killed the bird. And when he killed the bird, he killed the song. And when he killed the song, the family died. And the meaning in that myth, according to Campbell, and I see it, is that we've done a similar thing to nature. We've kind of killed the song of nature. And in doing so, we run the greatest peril of killing ourselves, not just physically, but spiritually as well. He tells the stories of the bushmen in the Kalahari who, when they're out hunting or in their daily events, they hear what they describe as a knocking at some part of their body. Sometimes it's an organ. Sometimes it's sort of a vague presence in their body. But they always stop. they stop and they listen to that knocking. And that knocking may mean any number of things. It may mean somebody's sick at home or somebody needs your attention. There's danger in the air. There's something around you that is calling to your inner hearing. And they give that very serious consideration. And their opinion about people who don't listen to that knocking is that they're foolish. What a foolish thing not to listen to that. We've learned to see the planet in a certain way, and we're all, me included, we're all kind of trapped about it that way. It's rare among us, those who follow that kind of internal listening. When we stop and we give that an equal measure, wait a minute, I don't really feel this way. How many times have you done something or been about to do something and you kind of stop yourself? You hear that for some inexplicable reason, you just stop. Or you wait, or you don't go somewhere. Or you do go somewhere. Or you change course. And so I think that's the same kind of knocking that he is talking about with the Kalahari Bushmen. Well, the point is, how do we, if we accept the idea that the plant's alive, and at the end of this session, or toward the end, we'll just open it up, anything that we've been talking about this week. But if we accept this idea, how is it that we're going to learn to converse with this planet, this grand organism? And I'm struck by a couple of things that I've heard here this week. One is this idea of kiting. Just tune into a mountain somewhere. Or if you're on your fields, stop and listen to your fields for a moment. Just listen. Just open yourself up to listening to what they might be saying. Or singing. Or dancing. Who knows what languages the earth speaks in? It's a whole variety of things. There's a certain humility that comes from acknowledging that we don't have the only way, we don't have a lock on the means of communication on the planet or in the universe. So if the idea is that the planet is communicating in a lot of ways, our responsibility is to stop and listen. And what we have to realize when we're listening is that the planet also speaks in different time. The planet's been around billions of years. Our individual lives are a period at the end of a very long paragraph. So the kind of thinking that we need to apply to our listening too can include this element of time. And one of my favorite of all authors is a guy named Loren Isley, who writes about time in a way that no one I have ever read has been able to write. He's an anthropologist, archaeologist, a bone hunter by profession. And being a bone hunter, he finds himself often in places where time sweeps in and over him in an uncontrollable flood. One of his earlier poems talks about the changing landscape. And he's from the Midwest, so this is written in a farming sense. Here is the waste, the stone, the streaming sunset, where no clouds pass. Here where the hawk's dark wing goes lonely over sheep-bitten grass. Green ice once crawled and plowed the meadow. The boulders lie as they were dropped in that tremendous plowing. The crows cry, clamorous above it in the twilight evening. They do not stoop. The rich grain and the harvest are not found here. Nighthawks loop erratic spirals in the windy starlight. The fallow ground is sleeping, and I know with what ghost sleeping, deep under the sound. Oh, not for the long grass or the bells of grasses. The mice who love their hidden runways will soon pass. The boulders will lift and move. This land is sleeping in a dream of mammoth. Their heavy tread will sound again. Sometime their feet will shudder the last man from his bed. When I was going to school in Maine, I had a Maine farmer put that to me in another way. I was with a friend and they were idly talking about all the stones out there in the fields in Maine. If you've ever been to Maine, you know what a trial it is to try and farm anything. You've got stones and stones and stones, and big stone walls made of stones from the fields. And the story went that people in New England are fairly taciturn. They don't speak a lot. And they have a way of shutting up people who are asking silly questions. So the story goes that a guy came by and wanted to start some conversation with a Maine farmer, and he asked him how all those rocks got there in his field. And the farmer says, "Well, the glacier done brought them." And the fellow says, "Oh, well, what are you going to do with them all?" "Well, I'm going to wait till the glacier done comes and takes them away again." The question comes up, how do you create a myth? If a myth is a valuable thing to have, if what our emphasis is to learn how to speak or listen to the planet, how do you create a story? From where do these myths come? And in Joseph Campbell's interpretation, Jesus is a story, is a myth. Buddhism is a myth. All those creation stories have their mythic element to them. In his way of thinking, it doesn't matter if Jesus actually lived or not. It's the transcendent meaning of the story that's really important. He makes a distinction between religion and theology, as religion is the moving part, is the essence of it. Theology is when they got together and tried to write it all down and stop it, capsulize it in words that stop the flow. So the question for Moyer is, okay, what do we do? We used to have these myths of animal powers. We used to have these myths of places. We have the seeded earth, fertility, creation, the mother goddess. We used to have a mythology for celestial lights and for the heavens. But in modern times, we've moved beyond the animal powers, beyond nature and the seeded earth, and the stars no longer interest us except as exotic curiosities in the train of space travel. Where are we now, Joseph, in our search for a mythological way of being and a myth for man? Campbell answers, we can't have a mythology for a long, long time to come. Things are changing too fast to become mythologized. Question, how do we live without myths then? The answer is, the individual has to find an aspect of myth that relates to his own life. You have to be able to take the message of the hero, the message of Jesus, the message of all the great religions, and apply them to your own life and see that that is a pathway to living. And Campbell would argue that of all the potentials for a modern myth, this one, and this is the symbol, this is the new cross, this is the symbol that may attract that kind of attention worldwide. The individual myth will have to deal with what myths have always dealt with, the maturation of the individual from dependency through adulthood, through maturity, and then to the exit, and how to relate to this society, and how to this society to relate to other societies in the world of nature and the cosmos. That's what the myths have talked about from the beginning, and that's what this one, the new one, has got to talk about. But the society that it's got to talk to and about is the society of the planet. And until it gets that going, you don't have anything. And he then quotes the best expression of that myth as he sees it, which, interestingly enough, when I was browsing through your bookstore, I noted that the entire text of that story is contained in this little offering, this dedication to Paul and Carola Bow. Who were here from October 88 to June 89. I don't know what they were doing here or why this was chosen. Okay. Well, in 1854, the Indians of the Pacific Northwest were called together by their, what we referred to as their chiefs. They didn't really have chiefs in the sense that we did, with a military leader and somebody who spoke for everyone else. But they were called together because the government, Washington, wanted to buy their land. Governor Stevens was coming to sign treaties with them. And Chief Seattle gave a reply that is going down as kind of as legend, as an expression of what their feeling was toward the planet. It says, "The great chief in Washington sends us word that he wishes to buy our land. The great chief also sends words of friendship and goodwill. This is kind of him, for we know he has little need of our friendship in return. But we will consider your offer. We know that if we do not sell, the white man may come with guns and take our land anyway. How can you buy or sell the sky or the warmth of the land? The idea is strange to us. If we do not own the freshness of the air and the sparkle of the water, how can you buy them? Every part of this earth is sacred to us and our people. Every shining pine needle, every sandy shore, every mist in the dark wood, every clearing and humming insect is holy in the memory and experience of my people. The sap which courses through the trees carries the memory of the red people. Our dead never forget this beautiful earth, for it is the mother of the red people. We are part of the earth, and it is part of us. The perfume flowers are our sisters, the deer, the horse, the great eagle, the heat of the pony. These are our brothers. The rocky crests, the juices in the meadows, all belong to the same family. So when the great chief in Washington sends word that he wishes to buy our land, he asks much of us. The great chief sends word he will reserve us a place that we can live comfortably to ourselves. He will be our father, and we will be his children. So we will consider your offer to buy our land, but it will not be easy, for this land is sacred to us. This shining water that moves in the streams and rivers is not just water, but the blood of our ancestors. If we sell you land, you must remember that it is sacred, and you must teach your children that it is sacred, and that each ghostly reflection in the clear water of the lakes tells of events and memories in the life of my people. The water's murmur is the voice of my father's father. The rivers are our brothers. They quench our thirst. The rivers carry our canoes and feed our children. If we sell you our land, you must remember and teach your children that the rivers are our brothers and yours. And you must henceforth give the rivers the kindness you would give any brother. We know that the whites do not understand our ways. One portion of the land is the same to them as the next, for they are strangers who come in the night and take from the land whatever they need. The earth is not their brother, but their enemy, and when they have conquered it, they move on. They leave their father's grave behind, and they do not care. They kidnap the earth from their children. They do not care. Their father's grave and their children's birthright are forgotten. They treat their mother, the earth, and their brother, the sky, as things to be bought, plundered, and sold like sheep or bright beads. I know not. Our ways are different from your ways. But perhaps it is because the red man is a savage and does not understand. The air is precious to us, for all share the same breath. The beast, the tree, the people, they all share the same breath. How does he know that? From what point of reference does he come up with words like these? Or is this something that some poet of the time, translating the speech, inserted? The wind must also give our children the spirit of life, and if we sell you our land, you must keep it apart and sacred as a place where even the white people can go to taste the wind that is sweetened by the meadow's flowers. Holden. You must teach your children that the ground beneath their feet is the ashes of our grandparents, so that they will respect the land. Tell your children that the earth is rich with the lives of our kin. Teach your children what we have taught our children, that the earth is our mother. Whatever befalls the earth, befalls the children of earth. If the people spit upon the ground, they spit upon themselves. This we know, the earth does not belong to the people belong to the earth. This we know. All things are connected like the blood which unites one family. All things are connected. Whatever befalls the earth befalls the children of the earth. The people did not weave the web of life, but are merely a strand within it. Whatever we do to the web, we do to ourselves. He goes on lamenting the passing of his people and ends up by stating that one thing we know, our God is the same God. The earth is precious to God. Even the white people cannot be exempt from a common destiny. We may be brothers and sisters after all. We will see. Well, I don't have much else to say about this. It's not the kind of thing that that has a lot of words attached to it. The meaning really is to go out there and find the music, to notice the dance, to have some gratitude to the planet for sustaining our lives, and have that translate into some action. I was talking to Dave the other day about the forest, and he's someone who studies old growth forests. The idea that we are so intelligent that we can afford to cut down all the virgin systems on the planet is just insane. We have so few models of systems that sustain themselves that when we cut them down, what do we have left to study? We know so little about this planet that we don't even know how many species are on this planet, how many life forms there are, what we commonly call life forms. We know that they're disappearing at a rate estimated at 1 an hour, never more to be seen. I was talking to another person from the village here who is a teacher, and she brings these things up to her students. And her encouragement is to get angry. Don't you get angry when you hear this? And the response is no. They really don't. They're sort of flooded with calamities. Besides, they got other things to think about. And I get angry. When I allow myself to sink into a thought about a particular thing, like the rape of the land, of the rainforest, or the mistreatment of the planet, I get really angry. And for myself, that's just a very real emotion that comes bubbling through me, and then I want to do something with that energy. I feel like maybe it's better that I'm angry than I don't feel anything at all. Yeah, Jen.
You asked a question while you were reading Chief Diallo's speech, and I assume it was a rhetorical question, but I like the answer, and my answer will be obvious, but I think it's important. The Native Americans lived very close to nature. I don't believe that we can regain this consciousness without living close to nature, and we're going to have to do that despite the fact that we're an urban or suburban people. It's going to be very difficult. How can you regard the river as your brother or your sister unless you live very close to it and you depend upon its waters in an experiential way? There are too many treatment plants between us and the river.
One response to that is all over Japan, they have this program that all the school kids are involved with called Salmon Come Back. And the school kids release fish into the streams. And in doing so, they have to learn a lot about the streams, the life cycle of the fish in the streams. And salmon are perfect because they don't just live in the ocean and they don't just live in the streams. They live in amongst all those different habitats and everything in between. So in taking responsibility for the salmon as a species, as an animal, they also end up taking responsibility for the watershed. And in doing that, they learn a lot about what impacts the watershed, and they go out to people, and there's nothing like a bunch of fifth graders coming up to you and asking you, please, to be careful with the stream because they've just released 2,000 fish. And here's some information about how you can be careful with the stream. And that program has been imported to the country, the states here. It's going great guns in Washington. And it's called Adopt a Stream. And the kids do that. School groups do that. A school will take as their responsibility a watershed. And they will release the fish, and they'll clean up the stream and provide gravel, learn about the environmental conditions necessary for the salmon to be successful. They remove logs that are blocking their path, leaving, making sure planting areas. Salmon need places to hide in the shade. The stream can't get too warm. They have a fairly narrow tolerance in temperature. A lot of streams in Washington have been cut right down to the stream, removing all the cover. So they learn about all this stuff because they're going to let loose these live things. And they have this connection to this animal that goes away from them. And it goes out in the great world, which is really, it's a mythical element. It goes out into this great world, has this amazing transformation, and lo and behold, comes back. So a couple years down the road, these kids, which were in fifth grade, which are now in seventh and ninth grade, are waiting for the king to come back. Long live the king is the slogan that you see around Puget Sound. So that's one way that urban people can become involved in recontacting with nature. I have a feeling that garden boxes and urban agriculture hold great promise that way. There's a great reference, if any of you are environmental or urban planners, there's a great reference in here about folks who are doing that. How to turn the city into some place that's green and alive. There are techniques and strategies all over the planet for helping to reconnect people. And a lot of the power of, long after Jesus departed from the planet, the symbol of the cross carries tremendous meaning. It's a point where people clarify, integrate, become fulfilled. If we have a new symbol, the symbol of the planet, that transcends nationalities, it transcends religions, transcends kinship groups. If people start identifying with that symbol as home, that'll go a long way too. Yeah.
It seems like one of the best things you could do is deal with children. I see people connecting it with all kinds of stuff, like transcendental meditation, weird stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But to teach our children to be in touch with their intuitive selves, it seems like it would be doing a lot to battle the technology. They're always entertained, there's always TV, there's very little silence in their lives. It just seems to be able to teach them that, this is a natural thing. When I was little, I was in touch with this, and it somehow got educated right out of me. And it's still there, but getting back in touch with it as an adult is harder.
Yeah.
I went to school, my son was about fifth grade, and I taught the kids the song that John Denver has on one of his albums. It's every one of us to be wise. Find your heart. Open up both your eyes. We can all know everything without ever knowing one.
Yeah, to share with you some of the things that we do with our kids. We'll take Alethea out and we'll dance the music of the stream. And we'll take her out and we'll dance the wind. Or Jackie will do watercolors with her, real quick things, where she picks up the patterns of the flow, the ebb and flow of things. She talks to all the animals and all the plants. I think probably most little kids do. What they need from us is permission to do that. And one of the most powerful experiences for kids is seeing their adults, their parents, modeling some of that stuff. One of the things that we do on the island now and a lot of is in our efforts to understand some of the music of the planet, we're trying to draw on old strategies for getting there. So there are a number of people on the island who do drumming ceremonies. And without doing it with you, it's hard to explain, but the idea is that the sound of the drum enables you to go to a place where you wouldn't otherwise go. It's like a curtain that you can go through. There's another thing called the medicine wheel that comes from the Plains tribes. And there are people doing the medicine wheel on the island. I have half of myself that looks at that a little skeptically. And the other half says, shut up. And just go and see what's there. I think the powers of ourselves to delude ourselves are tremendous. So I think Campbell's exactly right. We are struggling with trying to create a new mythology, a new set of rituals, drawing from different rituals, from different traditions, and seeing what works, seeing what it is that lends meaning and fabric to our lives and connects us back to the planet. There's a lot of floundering around.
Well, Doug, I don't want to be pessimistic now, but if you actually study, say, people now, men, what their myth is right now, the dominant myth in our society is make a lot of money now, follow all your tongue. That's the dominant myth of our college graduates, too. Right now. That'll make you happy. That'll solve your problems.
If you just make a lot of money? Yeah, I wonder if that's going to shift. You know, during the early 70s, late 60s, early 70s, there was this tremendous move, although apparently statistically it wasn't as large as we might be want to believe. But nevertheless, it really did shatter a lot of our perceptions about life and called into question a lot of those things. And then the 80s came and all the kids won MBAs. And
well,
now...
These are the kids of the hippies of the 50s.
Yeah. Right, right. And now, the kids that I talk to, depends where I am. A lot of them want Jaguars. They just want to make money. And others, there is this real calling for, well, what can I do for the planet? What can I do? And I'll finish speaking, and they'll say, well, what can I do? And so I tell them about Adopt-A-Stream, you know, and tell them about planting forests and restoring the earth. And my hope is that in doing those actions, when they cross that threshold from interest to action, that when they plug that plant in the ground, or that tree, or release those fish, that they have some sort of spiritual connection now to the earth, back to the earth, that will sustain them, that will change their way of walking from then on. That's my hope. You know, I don't know what other grounds to go on. I don't think people's powers of visualization are great. And I know from teaching whole brain stuff that the more you use your whole body, the more integrated you are, the better you remember, the more you learn. So. Jerry.
I was interested in hearing Dale talk more, about how the whole Gaia and emerging global consciousness, you know, what it stirs in you, Dale, or how you relate to that in terms of a person who is
I'm still a scientist, and so I'm not really into the spiritual side of it. I tend to look at, you know, old growth forest, this is the way it works. And it's evolved this way for 2 million years. Well, I don't tend to me it's not a spiritual thing, it's a physical, biological thing. I'm kind of stuck on that. Even though I work with a group of people search out certain forests and sit there, meditate, try to do it. Spiritual experience, sometimes we do. But I don't see the force that way.
Mm-hmm.
It's a biological, physical thing that functions a certain
way. So you never talk to a tree?
I have. I've put trees. I've taken classes out on what trees they make. I try it, but I don't do it. I mean, it's a myth to me.
Yeah, I feel a similar. Part of my confusion is I tend to associate the myth with being real, and the myth is a different kind of reality. And that's the reality that I am less comfortable understanding, I'm less familiar with.
I can accept it if it means the survival of the earth, and I think it does. You know, I teach romantic poetry, these poets in England at the turn of the century, the 1830s or something, were filled with Gaia. You know, they're called nature worshippers, but it involves much more than that. It involves exactly what you're talking about, hearing the music of nature, developing a keen eye for what is there, and using that as a stimulus for thinking. Well, what could be better? You know, a stimulus for meditating. And then they were washed out by the Industrial Revolution.
Yeah, there's so much power unleashed in that revolution.
Coming around again, because we're disgusted with what the Industrial Revolution evolved.
Yeah.
So just as they were a reaction to the Enlightenment.